When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Mind Escape. Are you ready?
Are you ready to escape your mind?
All right, folks, welcome back to Mike and Maurice's Mind Escape. We have episode number, 309 tonight.
Wow.
Special episode. You know, I was talking with Dr. Greg Little, and he was doing the survey thing, and we decided to link up and do this episode on the solar eclipse that happened last week, and just talk about any sort of anomalies that happened. He'll go into it more. I'll let him describe it. But if you want to support Dr. Greg, go down to the bottom. I've got a link to all of his books and his X profile. If you're on Twitter or X, whatever you want to call it, go check him out on there. He's constantly posting stuff about mounds and Native American culture and all that kind of wonderful stuff. So go check that out. If you want to support Mind Escape, the best way to do it is click the Linktree link down below. There's tons of stuff on there. Leave us a nice review. Check out all of our other stuff. Also, Dr. Greg is in our documentary, As Within, So Without, from UFOs to DMT. Go check out that documentary. The link is also down below. But without further ado, welcome back on. How are you?
I'm good. Well, thank you so much. I'm in the process of getting ready to post this, so I will do that now. I know there are people waiting on Facebook and Twitter. I do not know how many there will be, but we'll see in a moment.
Okay.
So I want to thank you. I want to start by thanking you for doing this. I appreciate it very, very much. You're a really good outlet for this. You know, I know you have quite a few people and so on that that watch your podcast, and I've enjoyed being on. How many times have I been on your podcast?
I mean, you might be on the most out of anybody. I'm trying to think, maybe like 9, 10 times, maybe.
Really?
You came on with P.D. Newman recently, and we did the whole Native American entheogen episode. So we've done a lot of episodes, that's for sure.
I may actually talk a bit about PD in this, some of his theories. But anyway, so thanks a lot. And we are going to talk about the magnetic survey we did. But I guess what I'd like to do is start with the background of this thing, where it came from and why. So it took me a while to find where I wrote all this. But back in 1994, and this is a reissued copy of the book Grand Illusions, which came out in 1994. The original cover I want to show, this was the original cover. And my wife and others said, it's got a black cover on it. Don't do that. But anyway, we reissued it. And on pages 112 and 113, there's a section, I know people can't see this, but it's called The Night Effect. And over here, it's called the eclipse effect. Is that it? Yeah, the eclipse window. So what I speculated back then, and this was after spending some time with at least one true Native American shaman, I think I posted the the wrong video to people. So I probably need to go back and try this again.
Okay.
Have you posted on your your Twitter account?
No, this? not since we've been live. Over the last minute or two.
Because I posted the wrong one. I posted an old one up there that was on your site. So yeah, let me pull it up. See.
Yeah, I mean, it might have just been for the channel or something.
I did the wrong one there.
Here, I'll post something too.
There it is. Okay.
But yeah, no, I appreciate your thank
you. I got
you
it now.
You're welcome, obviously, anytime. And this, like you said, I thought this was a cool idea. And yeah, let's do it.
All right, so I'm going to take 1 second here and redo this.
Okay. You're fine.
Jeez. Strange. Go ahead.
But yeah, no, I mean, anybody that's listening, leave us a comment about your experience with the eclipse. If you saw it, if you had some weird experience or anything like that. I saw it. I was just talking with Dr. Greg. My wife came home early from work, had some glasses. We watched it, took turns. We tried to get our little guy outside. He's a little over two. He wasn't leaving the glasses on, so we didn't want to take the chance him looking up. But yeah, no, we're not in the direct path. We're slightly off of it here in the Detroit area. But, I mean... Definitely.
Do you want to show that you took some pictures?
Oh,
right?
Yeah. Here, I'll pull up some. I have some pictures. Yeah, good idea. Here's, here, let me pull up, take our names off there. Here's, let me see if I can find a better one. So it's weird. It kind of just does look like the sun there. You get a little bit of a cross effect through the middle. There you go. There's that one. That's kind of like a close-up of it. Again, unless you have like a high-resolution camera or really know what you're doing, it's really hard to take pictures, even not of the eclipse, right? So
okay.
That was a weird one. I saw there was like a little crescent, which is kind of what the – if you see that little crescent in the little aura underneath, that's kind of what the eclipse here looked like if it was turned slightly – to the left a little bit. That's kind of what the full eclipse looked like here. All right.
So I know that nobody heard the initial one, although this will be recorded and posted. But anyway, back in 1994, I wrote about the eclipse window and the night effect. The eclipse window had to do with a set of rituals that I know that Native Americans did when they knew about eclipses. And of course, there are mound sites we've actually discussed on your podcast before that predicted eclipses because they charted the 18.61 year lunar cycle. So we know there were sites that did that. I know too, I've talked to some that actually had been involved in some eclipse rituals. And then there's some things in the old literature, and it's more than just, you know, the chief coming out and saying, I'm going to blot the sun out today, and then saying, now I'll show you my power and bring it back. It's more than that. So I have always been interested also in electromagnetic effects, and I've looked at and speculated about mounds and earthworks and why they were shaped the way they were and what the effect would be with people moving through these various shapes, through openings, going into earthwork circles, octagons, and so on. And it's been very interesting to me. So in 1992, a substance called, or a mineral called magnetite, was discovered in the human brain. And it made it... it made sense of a disorder that has been quite controversial in medicine for decades, and it's called electromagnetic sensitivity. There actually are people who can sense a magnet placed behind their head. There are people that are electromagnetically sensitive who get headaches. They have a lot of stress and anxiety in certain electromagnetic fields, with certain frequencies and strengths. And I have always believed that there's something to this that was with the magnetic effects and its effect on brain chemistry that related to the conducting of rituals, not just the use of drugs in it, which we may or may not talk about here a bit later, but just the effects of moving through different electromagnetic fields. And I believe that during an eclipse, I thought that during an eclipse, there would be some sort of an electromagnetic blip that would occur because the solar winds are blocked by the moon in a full eclipse. The solar winds are blocked by the moon. There is research, scientific research, numerous studies that do say that the electromagnetic fields on Earth and the magnetic field do change a little bit during an eclipse. And as soon as the eclipse is over, they return to normal. So I wanted to see if the eclipse, if this effect was strong enough in an eclipse to actually move a needle on, like this is it's not cheap, but this is a good hiking compass. It is an engineering compass. The Army had these, a lot of people carried them. An archaeologist commented to me that he knew there were magnetic changes on the Earth during an eclipse, but he doubted they would be strong enough to move a needle on a compass. And the idea that I had is that if it could move a needle on a compass, then it could move magnetite in the brain. We know now that magnetite that is in the brain, particularly in the hippocampus and limbic system, that it actually physically moves in the brain because of magnetic fields. As you go from different fields, the magnetite physically moves. And in the process, it should create some sort of biochemical changes in the brain. So it sounds like a far out theory, but that's really what I wanted to test. There's one more piece to this. In the late 1980s, around 1988 and 89, and then in the 90s, there was a researcher by the name of Nicholas Reiter. His last name is spelled R-E-I-T-E-R, not Reiter as in writing, but R-E-I-T-E-R. Reiter did research with UFO abductees. And what he did was he found a number of UFO abductees. The exact number was 15. And these UFO abductees all had magnetic sensitivity. He tested them, and all of them could reliably tell when a magnet was moving around their head, around the back of their head. And when it wasn't there, they could tell. And all of these people claimed to have strange experiences at night, everything from UFO abductions to having visitations, strange visitations from what appeared to be alien beings. He set up an experiment. He started by creating a device he called a MEM, M-E-M, and it stood for Magnetic Event Monitor. And this little device he put under the beds of the 15 abductees. And then every day he would come and he'd take some notes from them. What kind of experiences did you have that night? Did you sleep okay or whatever? And he would check the monitor, see if there were magnetic events during the night, which actually in his research were defined as a movement in the needle, a magnetic force strong enough to move the needle. And he used about 5 degrees. It was somewhere between 4 and 5 degrees. It had to be that much in order for the magnetic event monitor to record. What he found was this, that on the nights that the UFO abductees had strange experiences, generally they were visitations, a few of them reported abductions. On those nights, he found that the magnetic monitors did in fact register that something had happened. And he also had it to where it would register the time that it happened. Now, this research was published it started in a scientific journal, and then he published 3 articles in alternate AP magazine, which Brent Raines and I were then editing. That's why I know a lot about this. I read and edited his articles. So again, there was a strong correlation, close to one-to-one correlation between these magnetic events and people having the weird visitation experiences.
I have a quick question.
Go ahead, sure.
So what are we talking here? Is this more, do you think, because now we're talking about abductions and weird anomalies.
I know.
Do you think that this is something like some sort of side effect of magnetism and us being on this planet, and or do you think that there's some sort of teleological explanation, meaning that there's purpose behind it from some other sentient entity or being or beings or something along those lines?
Well, that's the big question, and that's the one I was going to sort of answer at the end. But I will.
All right,
I will
answer.
I'll answer a bit of that now. The thinking is that certain people, because of brain structure or electromagnetic sensitivity, or maybe a certain amount of neurotransmitters in different areas of the brain, maybe there's something about the light antennas that we all have inside of our eyes that I've talked about many times on your show. The rods and the cones are actually antennas that pick up different frequencies in the electromagnetic energy spectrum. But there's something different about these people, to where maybe they can sense something that everybody else can't sense. Maybe they can see them, and maybe it takes a certain electromagnetic frequency to make it work. So that's part of the theory too. I haven't said what I really think yet, and that I think I'll save to the end. But what he found is that there was a period when this all peaked. All of the magnetic events occurred between 2:30 and 3:30 in the morning, and they peaked around the time period of 3 a.m., specifically 3:15. 3:15 is when they peaked, 3:15 a.m. Now, he did not say whether this was, I don't remember him saying whether it was standard time or daylight saving time or whatever. But at that point in time, electromagnetic fields are extremely stable because they have been out of the solar winds for hours. You know, it's nighttime and it's real stable. That's what I call the night effect. Weird things happen at night and people say, oh, it's dark and it's spooky, you know, and you can get spooked and all that. But the other thing is this, the electromagnetic fields, the ambient fields are much more stable than on the side of the earth where the sun is shining because the solar winds. So this 3:15 thing in the morning got me thinking maybe the exact same thing happens in a solar eclipse, that there is a magnetic event that occurs at the solar eclipse. We do know through scientific experiments that biologist that said that he didn't believe that it could possibly be that strong. So, I set this little survey up. I asked people to go to mound sites. Some people did not go to mound sites, but they recorded elsewhere.
Are we still up? I had a weird event on my end just now. That was weird.
Yeah.
Seriously.
Okay.
I don't know. Well, there was some sort of magnetic anomaly happening over here. So.
All right. Well, I don't know.
No, I don't know.
Maybe somebody is listening to this and creating some
the machine elves. They're getting us.
Yeah. Yeah. All right. So I set this up on Twitter and Facebook and asked people, and I specifically asked, take a field compass. Don't use your phone. A lot of people wanted their phone. The phone doesn't measure the magnetic field the same way as a field compass does. And I wanted to know if it would actually physically move a needle, because if it physically moves a needle, it can physically move the magnetite in the human brain. So initially, a lot of people said they were going to do it. A lot of people weren't able to. I told people how I was going to record, that I was going to use a camera and put it on the whole time, put it on the face of the compass, because it would be several minutes And if you're watching the needle, then you can't look up and look at the eclipse. That's the thing. And even I got to the point where I used a really good video camera to record the needle. And then I saw the full eclipse and it was incredible. So I moved that camera up quick and used the zoom on it to get a shot of the full eclipse and put it back. But other people, including a scientist out there, recorded the whole thing. A lot of people simply watched it. And altogether, I got 10 usable responses. There were people that said, my data, I really can't trust it because I mainly watch the eclipse and I glance down at it now and then. So out of the 10 responses, there were five that were almost identical, virtually identical. And only one of those five was actually watching the needle. And that person watched it almost the entire time and was not in the 100% eclipse window. That person was in like the 99%. And I will say there's a massive difference in viewing it between 99% and 100. I've seen other eclipses that are 99% and 100 is so different. It's an amazing thing. And I'm glad I saw it. It's probably the only one I'll ever see, because the next one that I could see is probably 20 years away. So those five, there were 10 people altogether. Five had identical results. And those results, including what I saw, there was a movement of the needle at the exact moment of the full eclipse. And all of these were in Missouri and in Arkansas, and two in Indiana, and one in, I believe it's Ohio. The person, I didn't write down the exact location on my little data sheet here. There were five in Ohio, including Serpent Mound and on Monk's Mound. And while I know people were really excited about that, the problem with those sites is they have thousands of people during an eclipse. And that's what they said. At the moment of the eclipse, you know, people jumped up and down and, oh, yay, and all that. And that actually can cause some electromagnetic disturbances. But out of 10, five said they saw nothing. All five of those that saw nothing, none of them recorded it. They all just simply watched it. And virtually all of them said, I had to look up. I had to look up now and then. So the five that saw it all saw it's a subtle movement. It began again right at the moment of the full eclipse. It was between a half a degree and 1 degree. That's what it was. And it's very subtle. You really had to watch closely, or you had to film the thing happening up close, because a half a degree is 1/720th of that circle. That's a half a degree, and it's really hard to see. Out of the five that saw it at the beginning, four people also, two people, just two people saw it at the end. The person who I've said is a scientist saw it at the beginning and the end. He used a really good camera. And when I saw it, I didn't notice the direction. I was so shocked because I didn't think there'd be any result at all. I didn't think it would work. I didn't see the direction that it went. I couldn't figure out which way it went. It was so subtle. But he saw it move one direction, and then when the eclipse ended, it moved the other direction. So those are the results. Five saw it. Five did not, 50-50. Some of the people that didn't see it, the five that didn't see it, they weren't all in the full eclipse zone. Some of them were in the 90-95%, 90-98% area. So that's the theory, and that's the results. If anybody wanted to ask a question.
We do have a couple questions. Right. Well, shout out real quick to True Seekers. Thank you so much. Appreciate the super chat. Scarlet H is asking, Greg, could the 3 a.m. time be the reason a lot of people wake up at that time, regardless of the time that they sleep?
My answer to that would be I would certainly agree with that. I don't have any proof of it. There's no proof, except I know that it's kind of a click. I used to call it the 3 a.m. click. In fact, I woke up last night at 3:15, and I woke up the night before at 3:15. I don't know why, because normally I
woke up last night the same, not 3:15, but like 3:30-ish.
Yeah.
I mean, I'm a night owl as it is, so it's not that much longer after I go to bed, but you could say, oh, somebody's got to go to the bathroom, or your bladder's only so large, or whatever. The interesting thing I will say, and I don't know if you can speak to this too, but and part of it's physiology in biology, but if you depending if somebody uses alcohol or cannabis, this can vary. I tend to use cannabis sometimes, so I don't dream as much as a normal person. But when I wake up at 3 o'clock and I go back to bed, not only do I dream more often, but I can also induce lucid dreams way more easily that way.
Yeah. Well, I don't dream much anyway. I literally block my dreams. Years ago, I used to do a lot of dream analysis, and I do them on myself. I did it with people too. I used to do demonstrations in college classes where I'd have students make up dreams on the spot very quickly, make them up, and then reveal things about themselves based on what they make up very quickly, which it's basically a psychology projection technique when you ask somebody to make up a dream. But sometimes you reveal some rather embarrassing things about yourself when you do that. But I do think that there is something to it. I do believe that the brain is being affected by magnetic fields. Certainly, we know that some people are very sensitive to magnetic fields and some are not. And I've actually written that I believe that skeptics, there are ultra skeptics that believe everything is nonsense. And by everything, I mean people that see UFOs, people that have abduction experiences, people that see entities or little beings, they just think it's all nonsense, or they say, oh, it's a hallucination, meaning it's all in your head and it's all biochemical.
Well, that's always the problem I run into with this is like the people that you're talking about, it's not even worth engaging with them because they've already made up their mind the other way. So like we can obviously have dogma within these fringe communities where people are dogmatic. There are liars, there are charlatans, there are grifters.
Oh, sure.
there are that does exist. I mean, let's not pretend it doesn't, but at the same time there are your skeptics kind of doing the same thing where they're writing books and blogs and reviewing things. Some of these people wouldn't have jobs either if it wasn't for the fringe people that they're talking about. So that's a thing too. So for me it's like this is something I always ask, and this, you know, when we made the documentary and you contributed your part and everything, it's something I asked myself. I said, is it possible that anybody that's ever had a UFO sighting or an alien, you know, encounter, is it possible that it's some sort of mind virus or whatever? And it's just, to me, that would be as absurd as some, you know, external force or entity or whatever being the cause of that. Meaning that I don't know the answer, and I'm not pretending that I do, but I will say there's got to be something to this of thousands and millions of people. So it's like either the mind is so suggestible and we're just biological androids, which I guess, again, I always leave that door open, or there is some sort of rhyme or reason or purpose or, you know, plan or whatever, you know.
So let me get weird with this. So, and I've written this in several books, I believe there's a difference between skeptics and those who have experiences. First of all, in talking to a lot of skeptics, I know they really haven't had any experiences. If you went outside and you saw an alien being and you had the experience, somebody's not going to convince you that you didn't. But here's the thing. I think that skeptics don't have sufficient magnetite in their brain to be sensitive to it. And I think people that are overwhelmed with these experiences have too much magnetite in their brain. And I think that the chosen ones, like the old biblical idea of the chosen ones, I think
their brains were made out of pure magnetite.
Well, no. I think that there is something, and magnetite would be somewhat, the amount of magnetite in the brain would have something to do with where you were born and what your parents regularly consumed, what's in the ambient atmosphere and so on. But it's probably also somewhat genetic in that it would affix in certain spots in the brain. Initially, it was found in the hippocampus. That's where it was found in 1992. And I was really shocked when I read that, and I wrote about that in 1994. But that's my real belief in this. I think that it does relate. It may not just simply be magnetite. The magnetite probably interacts with certain neurotransmitters in different areas of the brain. And the truth is, a lot of differences in us in personality and in intelligence and verbal ability and mathematical skill and all of that, that's all determined by genetics. And it has to do with the way the brain forms. It has to do with whether different areas of the brain are larger or smaller. There are differences, for example, in criminal populations. This is research from the 90s. We talked slightly about
that's
this
your before. Background, right, is criminal psychology.
Yes, yeah. The most violent criminals have literally physically smaller prefrontal cortex, which is right up here, right behind the forehead. And the prefrontal cortex is where it's always been speculated. That's where the conscience is. But it's the area where we make decisions, and it can, and those decisions can override impulses. For example, I'm sure at some time in your life, you've been so ticked off at work at a boss that you wanted to say something to him. But a part of you said, nah, I don't want to do that. I'd lose him. There's no use getting him angry. I might lose my job. Well, that's what the prefrontal cortex is doing. It is tamping down the emotions. It's thinking through the emotions.
So with somebody that has that like explosive disorder or whatever that thing is, they have the same thing where that part of the...
That's who they studied to come up with this. They literally took these people and they did MRIs on them and CAT scans on them to measure the physical size of the prefrontal lobe as well in comparison to other brain areas.
Because I know that, well, I forget what it's called, but like back in the day when they didn't really know anything about brain chemistry and physiology, they had this, you know, like this part of the brain does this, and then I forget what it's called, but obviously that's wrong. But what I find interesting is there's proof. So like, I forget the whole story, but Einstein's brain was actually...
It's in a bottle, but
it's been cut up and like I forgot, preserved in some way. And some people have some pieces, and other people some. The guy that initially took it and was like on the run with it or something. I forget there's a weird story behind it. Yeah. Anyways, while they say like the size of your brain does not matter in terms of intelligence. Right. The thing that Einstein had that made him so different or so much more, I guess, transcendent or intelligent, is the one part of your brain where you can visualize, like mathematical stuff. Your visual cortex was a lot larger than the like a normal person. So, like, he was able to visualize things that people, like most people, can't. So, again, I think that I agree with what you're saying. Like, there's obviously we all have different strengths and different things based on our own physiology and chemistry and everything like that, and we have disadvantages too.
Absolutely. So I think that, again, skeptics have just different brains and they see the world differently. They never have strange experiences. The reason that I'm really in this, it started with my own experiences that I've never talked about and probably won't. And I was curious about them, you know, where's this coming from? And in thinking about my own experiences, it got me interested in other people's experiences. And I know we've been on and we've talked about the psychic, so-called psychic, Edgar Cayce, And Edgar Cayce, I don't believe, was a psychic. That's another story. I've got an article about that that is going into the ARE, which is the Cayce organization. But I don't believe Cayce was what people think of as a psychic. But I got interested in Cayce. I got interested in UFO abductees. I got interested in people that reported ghost sightings, all of that. And talked to the people, did a lot of interviews. I've never done MRIs or CAT scans on them, but I've read a lot of research about all that and published a lot in that field. So I do believe that there are physical differences in the brain and maybe certain connections. You know, the big difference, Einstein did have a much larger cortex. The cortex is the outer covering of the brain. Our brain, you know, has lots of folds in it. It's folded all over, and that's to make the cortex bigger and bigger. And then there are connections that run through it. And yes, there are certain areas that operate certain bodily functions. Like, you know, when you go to sleep, you don't have to, you don't have to consciously keep breathing. That's one thing. When you start thinking about that, when I did this in college, when I made people think about it in college, teaching classes, it kind of freaked them out because I'd say, you know, you're breathing, you're inhaling and exhaling. You don't have to think about that. How is that happening when you go to sleep?
I will say this, though. I recently, because of my medical stuff, have found out that I have sleep apnea. So now I have a CPAP machine. Now, let me tell you something. I didn't realize how much I was breathing through my mouth until I had to use this machine. It's like you have to keep your mouth closed. And then on top of that, you know, like breathing that if you open your mouth while you're taking in the oxygen, it just goes right out your mouth like a stream. It's like the weirdest feeling in the world. So like I don't know, I guess I've just been what they call a mouth breather my entire life. You know, if you want to say it's good or bad, I that's just what I've been doing, I guess. I don't know, you know, if I have a big brain. I know I have a big head. I have a size 8 fitted hat, which is pretty big, and it barely fits. But but yeah, that I find all that. There's actually good, great courses on that Einstein thing I was talking about. Yeah. Let me pull it up here and so I can recommend it to people. Great Courses is on Audible, where they go through different topics. There's the ancient Egypt one's great. Bob Breyer's got a talk on there, which is great. Okay, so this one's called Philosophy of Mind: Brains, Consciousness, and Thinking Machines by Patrick Grimm. It's the Great Courses, and he goes through like the evolution of thought and, you know, starts with the beginning of philosophy and stuff and then goes up, goes up through there and then gets to like science. And then he gets up to, you know, they were creating the first computers in Great Britain in like the 1800s, but they didn't have enough money for some of these people that were working on the stuff. It just kept, you know, bleeding them out and stuff, but very interesting. Check that out. But so back to the mound stuff and the magnetite and everything. My only question with the skeptic thing is, couldn't it just be though? And I'm gonna be honest. So like when we started the show, I was biased. I was like, oh, scientists and their dogma and blah 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 blah, and you know, repeating all the rhetoric you hear, the big shots, the Graham Hancocks, and the. You know, I didn't really know what I was saying in particular. So I just went full in on philosophy from the dialogues, read them a bunch of times, to analyzing the dialogues, to just what we know through the great philosophers that's been recorded. And through that process, I realized my own cognitive biases, biases of other people. Now when I look at anything and I'm looking, trying to understand the origin, I'm trying to understand it through what I either know about that person that was studying it or what I can know as a human being. And I just feel like with the skeptic thing, I'm not anti-skeptic anymore, but I just realize them as having a different type of dogma as the people that are like full on woo believers. Doesn't matter what they're told. They watched one YouTube video and whatever, but there's people doing real research. Like, you know, in these fringe community, I would say, you know, there are very honest people like you, and, you know, I can name a bunch that we've had on the show, but you can just go back and watch our episodes. I think I'm a pretty good curator of who is actually doing honorable research and who's not. And the skeptic thing to me is one in which, you know, even like for instance, Michael Shermer had what you're talking about, an experience with like a radio on his wedding day, and his wife, he was trying to fix this radio for months or something like that. And all of a sudden, on the day of his wedding, the radio starts playing and it's like his wife's dad's song to her, and everybody got emotional. It's just like, well, that sounds crazy that you wouldn't have looked at that and been like, there's some sort of rhyme or reason to that, you know, whatever it is. It doesn't have to be one specific. I think the problem is, what I'm trying to break down is through learning philosophy, through learning how the mind works, is language. None of us can agree on what we're talking about, because none of us really agree on terms, whether it's God, consciousness, you name it. All these words are words that are interpreted in different ways by different people. So I think for me, I've just come to understand it as like a language barrier or breakdown. And I don't know, I've had like Mick West on, and he seemed, you know, like we don't agree on stuff, but he didn't seem like he was the worst person in the world, you know? So it's like these people, whatever they think, again, it just comes down to, do you have a horse in the race? If you're running a channel debunking people, you have a horse in the race. I'm sorry, but you do. Whether you think you're doing something honorable or not, you still are in the game, so...
Yeah. Well, that's, I would agree with you wholeheartedly in all of that. But I really do think that there's a difference between the ultra skeptics and, I don't even want to call them believers, experiencers is a much better term, people that have experiences. And again, if you have an experience, then you know. You may not know what it is, but you know there's something out there, something. So I think that shaman in the mound building culture, shaman were hereditary. You could become a medicine person, a medicine man or a medicine woman, by, you know, being a helper, and learning how to do it. But shaman were usually hereditary. And I think there's a hereditary link there. Shaman definitely have experiences. And I think that they're born that way. A lot of people ask me all the time, and I think we've talked about this on your show too, why do they choose certain sites and why do they build these sites certain ways? Why do they make the geometric earthworks into certain shapes? Well, basically, it was a shaman that tells them to do that. And the shaman are in touch with something other people aren't. Shaman can walk through areas and they feel different forces. And to the skeptic that doesn't feel it, you know, they say, oh, that's nonsense. I could use other words, but I'm not going to. But they just say, that's complete nonsense. It's like dowsing. A lot of skeptics will say dowsing is complete nonsense. I've dowsed one time. It means nothing. I never had the inclination to do it, but I had a grandfather that did it. And he was very well respected in our town. He was an elected official in a little town in Pennsylvania. And his father did dowsing. I didn't know that till some years later. But I went on to a ranch, Bradshaw Ranch in Arizona, and did dowsing when there was a guy who does work in physics there who was monitoring the Bradshaw Ranch, which is like the earlier version of Skinwalker Ranch was Bradshaw Ranch.
Can you describe dowsing really quick? Because I'm sure there's going to be people that don't know what that
is. Dowsing is, you generally today use two metal rods that you hold it in your hand, and it would come, get a pencil here. I'm going to use this. But you'd hold the rod in your hand, and then it has an extension. But because the rod is kept in a round tube, it can easily swing. So you put one in each hand. Some people use wooden sticks that are always made out of certain sticks. And I've heard of different types of wood they use, so I'm not even going to name it, because somebody say, oh, no, we use this one. But you walk through an area holding them level in front of you. And as you walk through an area, the rods will turn around certain directions based upon what is under you. And it might be a flow of water. That's been the main use of dowsing. I know that some people did it for oil. And I know of many cases with oil dowsing where it didn't work. Edgar Cayce did oil dowsing with a group, and it didn't work. Water dowsing and electrical field dowsing is another thing. But there are many people that absolutely swear by it, and they will drill in these areas, and usually they find something. But skeptics will say, you know, it's hit or miss, it's just dumb luck or whatever, that if you do it enough, sooner or later, you're going to have a hit. So that's how dowsing works. But I think dowsing does pick up what is called subtle energy. And subtle energy is electromagnetic energy. The Earth generates its own field, and it's called the Schumann resonance. And I've talked about how to kind of meld yourself into a mound site, how to really feel the site and experience it. And it's not by going in and using drugs or anything. The first time you go to a mound site, if you really want to
experience
it.
That's not what I heard.
Yeah, well, whatever. The best way to do this is to go there, try to have nobody else there when you're there, or find a really quiet place. Find a place to sit. You don't have to sit on a mound. The whole area was used. But find a place where you can sit down, have some bare part of your body, even a finger, touch the earth, not necessarily the grass or a plant, but touch the earth. Close your eyes and focus your attention on the sound. Just focus on the sound and try to geolocate sounds. Hopefully there'll be birds, there'll be some wind noise through the grass or the trees or whatever's there. Just focus on the sound. And that will connect you to whatever energies there might be at the site. Now, of course, skeptics will say that's nonsense. That's fine. I don't care what they say. Lots of people do this and find that they connect with something. They feel some sort of spiritual connection to it. And sometimes they feel a not so spiritual connection. They feel bad things that might have happened there.
To your point, though, it's like that is real. We go on this camping trip to Northern Michigan every year. I've been going since I was like 5 or 6 years old. And it's on the banks of the Manistee River. And when we get up there, I mean, it's a state campground. So it's not, you know, there's some hikers and stuff like that, but there's not like a ton of people around or anything like that. But when you get up there and you've left the city and whatever, the stillness, like you're talking about the wind, the water trickling, it's like meditative. In fact, Maurice has even made a meditation video on this one site from around there. So it's a cool thing. And I do agree with what you're saying. I think there is some sort of frequency or resonance when you get, look, if everything's matter that's vibrating at a certain frequency, I don't know how what you're saying could be wrong. So...
Well, the Schumann resonance is the same. When I talk about melding with it, the brain generates an electromagnetic field. An electroencephalograph measures your electromagnetic field. An electroencephalograph, you know, they'll put it around your head, different areas of your head, and they're measuring your electromagnetic activity. All right, so you've probably heard of beta, theta, alpha, all that. Okay, so you reach the Schumann, your brain reaches the Schumann resonance or that magnetic field frequency when you are right between awake and asleep. That's when you reach it. And at that point, and that's a meditative state. You're not asleep, you're aware, but you're not totally awake. When you're right at that cusp between being awake and asleep, that is when you are in absolute harmony with the ambient frequency of the earth. And if you believe in like the plasma theory that Andrew and I put out in the book Origins of the Gods, the same theory that we both had since the 80s, actually, that we are mold, that there are electromagnetic plasmas that are definitely related to UFOs and abduction experiences and entity experiences and so on and visitations. When you're at that state, you are at that frequency. And that is the frequency where people have the experiences. And actually, I believe that that's where people are, like that 3 a.m. thing. And it, like when you wake up, it's your, before you wake up, you go through that frequency. And because we're on the dark side of the earth at 3 a.m., the, you are being bathed in the Schumann resonance. And I think it's 4.7 or 7.4. I can't, I have too many numbers floating in my head. Somebody asked me recently on a podcast about a bunch of mounds, just threw them out and wanted me to say, you know, all kinds of numbers from them. And I said, look, I, there's 8,000 mounds in that book. I cannot remember all of that. I remember the big ones. And even now when I post them, I got to look up stuff. I simply can't remember it all. And I'm getting old too. So I do believe that there's something to this. I believe in the Native American idea that all things are connected. I believe that all things are spiritual in the way they believe.
7.83 hertz.
There you go. I was close. I was going to say 4.7. Then I said 7.4 because I knew it was somewhere around there. But that's the ambient earth frequency. And it is it's an electromagnetic frequency that the earth puts out. And I've also told you on other podcasts that with all this electromagnetic stuff around us, from cell phones to electric wires everywhere to the Wi-Fi that's over here next to me, all the cell towers that are everywhere and G4, G5 and cell towers.
I mean, imagine if Tesla got his way, we'd be like all electrified by now with the amount of electricity in the air.
Right, yeah. I do believe that we're having more unbalancing experiences rather than the kinds where I've described in some of the books where Native Americans would have these experiences at critical times when a being would appear to them. Usually the being comes down from the sky and is bathed in light. They're almost always in a bubble of light. And then the being would come out at a critical time and talk to an individual. And the reason that those are in their legends is because they were important experiences that they had. And in the 50s, before we had all this, before we had all this electromagnetic energy, people saw, you know, that was the day of the Space Brothers. And people would say that, you know, a UFO landed and an alien looking sort of like us would walk out and tell us that we are in the process of destroying ourselves, that we're not just polluting the earth, but we are on the path of destroying ourselves with nuclear energy. And that has changed. You don't hear that anymore. You don't hear those kind of experiences. Things have changed as we have put out more and more electromagnetic pollution. And that's not a term I made up. That's actually in the medical literature. They're worried about electromagnetic pollution now, that it is causing anxiety and depression. You know, and there's a fantastic increase in mental disorders right now. And they believe that it has something to do with the electromagnetic pollution. And there's no doubt electromagnetic fields affect the brain. How do they do it? I think it's magnetite.
All that plus, think about all the actual space garbage in orbit. Like, it's almost like a gauntlet. Like, if anything tries to enter or exit, I mean, kudos to our space programs that get stuff out. But it's just when you see those, like, graphs and models where they show you how much stuff's up there, it's like, how is anything getting out or in? Like, that's insane.
Yeah. It is amazing. It is amazing. So let me summarize the results again, in case some people just came in. The magnetic survey had 10 really good responses. Five of them found no effect. In those five people, only one of them actually filmed the thing. I forgot to mention that at the beginning. One of them did film it, saw nothing. And he actually was the guy that was in the 98 degree. It was 98 degree coverage, not 100%. So five saw no response at all. Four of those five just looked at it, the compass a little bit and looked up at the sun, which I did too, but I filmed it. There were five that had the exact same result in the beginning. That is, five people saw a blip. That is, that the compass needle moved a half a degree to 1 degree at the very beginning of the eclipse. And then out of the five, Two saw it move back at the end of the eclipse. Out of the five that saw the needle move, four of those five actually filmed the whole thing. One of the people did not film it, but observed it. And he looked up at the, he said he couldn't help himself. He looked up at the eclipse when it was full. So he didn't watch it the whole time. But that's the summary of the results. I really thank people for doing this. There were another 10 or 20 people that said, well, my data is not really good enough. But the other thing I did, let me see if I can find it here. I thought I had one real close. Let me get up for 1 second. I'll be right back.
Okay. While he's getting up, I'll play. So I was viewing this in the Detroit area. We were at like 99.2%.
Sorry.
Yeah, on you're good.
Yep. I wouldn't be able to do it. But I made these T-shirts for the participants.
Look at that. Total solar eclipse. Look at that. That's a cool T-shirt.
Yeah, it is. And I actually autographed them. And I'd like to send you one.
Oh,
I have a XL here. I've only got an XL. And
you're good. How about this? I am definitely not an XL. I'm trying to get there.
Well, someday.
But I want you to give that to somebody else. Cause
I've already given them away. I've already shipped these.
Well, if you want to ship one to me, actually, you know who I'll give it? I'll give it to Maurice because he will wear it. I'll give
That'd
it to Maurice.
Good.
Okay.
Okay. But there you go. I'm even going to autograph it. I've never autographed cloth stuff before, but I'll do an autograph at the bottom. That's
awesome.
Actually kind of hard to do. I don't know how the NBA.
Yeah, I don't know.
Do it.
They must have special pens or something.
Well, there is. It took me a while to find it, but there are special pens.
Oh, okay.
But still, it's difficult. It's difficult.
Sure.
But that's my story. That's
so you
it.
Want me to pull up your video real quick? Let's
sure,
show some of these videos.
Sure, you can show people how I did it, and then when I quickly move the camera up to look at the full eclipse.
Okay. Here, let me pull it up here.
And again, I'll say a full eclipse is nothing like 99%. You don't need the glasses in a full eclipse.
Why is this so mini? I got to blow this thing up here. Hold on. Now it's tilted at an angle. Hold on. Oh, it's still on an angle. Hold on.
That's all right. That's how I filmed the thing. I hit a camera right over it looking at it. There you go. And if you have the sound, you'll be able to hear some of the sounds around me. And I had a light on my camera.
Oh my God.
Because it gets dark during the eclipse and I knew you wouldn't be able to see it. Okay. That's the full eclipse.
There we go.
Yep. And that's just using a really good video camera from around the year 2003.
Here, I'll play it one more time here.
I don't know why it was green at the bottom.
This was a cool idea. I wish more people did.
A bug moving around on it.
Yeah, I wish more people did like experiments and stuff if they were going to be. You know, everybody's setting up these festivals and rock concerts and jam band concerts and all sorts of cool stuff, but I like this kind of stuff.
That was that's just handheld, believe it or not. I just moved it up real quick and shot that.
Here, let me see if I can pull up, I think I took a couple. Here's a couple cool shots I took. This was through the glasses in my camera.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
During
my
the
wife
full.
Did that
this
also.
Is at the complete, you know, eclipsing.
Oh, wow.
Let me see this. This was from, you see the halo. Almost like a sundog effect a little bit, right?
Yeah.
There's a shot. Let me see here. Yeah, see that little to the right there?
Yes.
That's what the eclipse looked like here in the total eclipse when it was at, because we were at in outside of Detroit, 99.2%.
Right.
So imagine that turned, you know, kind of counterclockwise a bit. That's kind of what it looked like.
Well, I was at Towasagi Mounds in southeastern Missouri. It's in the middle of nowhere. It's near East Prairie, which is a tiny, tiny little town.
Yeah.
We'd been there before. That's a cool picture. That's a really cool
That
picture.
One, I think I changed the saturation a little bit, but I didn't do anything else. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, we thought there'd be nobody there at all. Actually, the people with me, my wife and two other people went along. We thought there'd be nobody because it's so remote. And as it turned out, there were about 25 people there. And the state of Missouri, it's a state park. It's a tiny little state park. And the Missouri Division of State Parks had employees at every state park to handle the crowds. And they had shut down a number of the parks because they said there were too many people, nowhere to park. You couldn't drive anywhere because the traffic was at a complete standstill. But they actually had T-shirts there at the park. They were selling. They weren't like this, but they had T-shirts there. But still, it was very quiet. It is dramatic. The full eclipse is dramatic. And I can see why you would do a ritual before it. During it, I could visualize pretty much what I have come up with how they did these rituals. They actually worked themselves into a frenzy before the full eclipse through whistles and drumming and certain kinds of dancing. But during the full eclipse itself, they were totally quiet, totally silent. And then when it ended, that was it. Because it gets light immediately. I mean, it's astonishing how there's light and then suddenly it's dark when it goes full. The temperature dropped dramatically. It was like 77 degrees when we were on the mound, but it cooled down probably to the 60s almost instantly, and a wind kicked up. It was very strange, actually.
Exact same thing happened here, but it went from like 50 or 55 to like 40, 45.
Yeah.
And I was just thinking in that moment, too, like I was outside because my wife and I were taking turns during the few minutes of the total. You know, one would watch our son and then we'd switch back and forth. When I was out there, I was thinking to myself, like, it is getting so cold. Imagine if, you know, the times of when, like, super volcanoes or there was some sort of asteroid or comet impact and all the debris blocking out the sun, everything would get so cold, right? Yeah. So, I mean, we know that. That's recorded in history too, you know, Lake Toba and all these different, you know, they can look and see the temperature variations. And I think there was one big one not that long ago in New Zealand that we were able to record through ancient texts and stuff, a temperature difference and stuff like that. Yeah. So, that's kind of crazy to think about that something like that could have that much. And you think, oh, okay, 10 degrees, 20 degrees, not that much. But imagine now growing crops and changes of cycles of seasons. And, you know, that can have a massive impact.
It's dramatic. It's a dramatic effect. Well, Maurice, Mike, good guy. You said Maurice.
I'll take it as a compliment.
I did this to you before in another show, and I was pretty
cooler name, bro. I don't take offense.
I don't know. I appreciate it. When we're done here, hang on a minute so we can I can get an address from you and I'll send this thing to you.
Yeah, so my question is, Scarlett wants to know, is there a way to buy one of these?
You know, I bought these on Amazon, and I didn't ask a guy to do it. There's a guy who kind of follows my work, and he follows my work, and he's made a bunch of T-shirts based on stuff I talk about mounds. One of them has the Mound Builder Society logo with some other things on it. Another one is the Native American term for all things are connected, which is a phrase that is used a lot in Native American literature. They are available on Amazon. There is a link on my Twitter page. It's probably way down, but I'll repost it tonight. When we get off this, I'll repost the thing. I'm not trying to sell the T-shirts, but actually I appreciate it. It's very well done. And before he posted it, he said, hey, is this okay with you if I do this? And I said, sure. So I wound up paying him full price to buy the ones that I mailed off to people. And I didn't mind doing it. If 50 people had done this, I would have mailed out 50 of them because I appreciate it. And I thought if I run out of them, I'm going to send them all a book because I appreciate them doing it. It was a way for me to look at a theory the only way I could look at a theory that I had back in 1992 to 1994, that's when it popped into my head. And that's a long time ago. But I couldn't test it any other way. So I'm glad I do plan on doing the 3 a.m. testing thing. I want to see if the magnetic blip is everywhere. Again, he tested it only with people that had these experiences, people that were first magnetically sensitive and secondly, people that had reported abductions, and they were all multiple abductees. They weren't just one-time abductees. They were multiple. So my belief is, well, this 3 a.m. click probably happens everywhere.
You don't have to convince me, man. I mean, yeah. 3 a.m.s, I mean, not recently within the last few years since we've had my son, but when I was younger, late 20s, early 30s, I was a night owl, so I'd be up doing research, looking into all this weird stuff, cannabis, psychedelics, whatever. And those were some of my weirdest experiences, were 2 to 3 a.m., like what do they call it, the witching hour or something like that, you know? Yeah. So, yeah, there's something to it. In fact, my wife and I still talk about this. When we were still living outside of Chicago in the suburbs, there was one night, I think it was like 2:30-ish, maybe it was 3 o'clock. We heard this owl, and I look out the window, and it's literally the moonlight, like a shaft of light coming from the moon, illuminating this owl sitting on the ground, and it's just doing this whoo hoo, and it kept us up for like an hour just doing this. And I just remember, like, this is weird. Like, what is this? I mean, you know, maybe it's taking in the moon or whatever, but go up in a tree, you know, let us get some sleep here. I don't need any UFOs showing up or any, you know.
Well, you know how skeptics say all this, you know, it's the deepest time of sleep, supposedly. And of course, that's when all kinds of things happen. When it's dark, you know, you can get spooked and so on, and you can see movements and shadows and whatever. And that it's all mind games. That's what they say. But I think there's something other than mind games at work here. I do believe that there's something going on. I think that electromagnetic fields are related to it, but there's something else to it. It's not just that, you know, you're hallucinating. It's not just that. There's something else going on. Maybe that can be the topic of something later, because that would take us a long time to dig into too. But it actually, all my ideas came from the Native American lore. It's all from their belief system. And actually, I didn't come up with any of this on my own. None of it. None of this is my theories or beliefs or anything else. It's just pieced together from what I have learned from Native American lore and the mound building populations. Incredible culture. Absolutely incredible. Very spiritual. And I believe they chose to live with nature. In fact, that's what they said they did, that it was all about harmonizing with nature. And I think that's why they rejected using the wheel. Even after wheels were over here, they still would pack everything up. When they had a horse, they packed everything up behind them and they would drag it. But at some point, all that sort of disappeared, and, you know, they got guns and they started using metal and so on. But that was after 90% of the mound building culture was killed off by the diseases that the Spanish brought in.
If you're interested in that too, you can, I'll post after we're done in the show notes, I'll post all the episodes that we've done with you in the past, including the most recent one that we did with me, you, and P.D. Newman, where we talked about Native American mounds and rituals and entheogens and psychedelics. Go check that out. But yeah, there was one we did where you went through kind of all the mound sites and the history. That was a really good, like a slideshow episode. So I'll put that up as well.
Excellent. Well, I'm done. I appreciate it very much. Like I say, hang on for a minute and we'll take care of some other business.
Okay.
But and thank you to everybody that participated in this. I know that a lot of people that participated will watch this, not live, but later. But I do thank you. And if you get one of those t-shirts, if you're one of those people that got a t-shirt, how about posting it? Let people know that I really did send it out. And I bagged them up myself, and I took them to the post office, you know, and signed them and did all that. So I want people to know that I really did it. There were a couple people that did this that didn't want them because they didn't want to give an address and a name. And I understand people wanting to be anonymous, you know, and in this day and age, you know, it is difficult to trust people. But
those
I definitely
people were Michael Shermer, or Mick West, they're secretly fans. They didn't want to give you the real information. I'm joking.
Whatever.
It's literally all the skeptics. They're like, I love this, but I don't want to admit it.
Well, I have told you before, there are some archaeologists that I am friends with that are unnamed that have said many, many times. They're not the archaeologists that follow me on Twitter. I got to protect those guys. There are a couple of archaeologists that are on my Twitter feed that are great. They don't believe in any of the, you know, the woo stuff, I'll call it that. But I can ask them questions about pottery and about symbolism and so on. And what is this, you know, what are the dates of this or that? And they answer, they're very, very good. They're great. But there are some that I have been friends with through the years, mainstream archaeologists that believe in Atlantis. They believe in a lot of weird stuff. They believe in Edgar Cayce, that there was something to that man, that he wasn't a hoaxer per se. They believe he was a shaman like I do. But they are unnamed and I've sworn that I'll never mention their names anywhere, but they're
Well, the other thing is you're not dogmatic. So like I think when you see those people like whatever you want to call them, archaeologists or scientists or whatever, I think when they attack people, it's not because the work's threatened, it's the rhetoric of whatever the person's using. So if they're being attacked first, I mean, the natural reaction is to attack back, right? I mean, or hey, I have real knowledge, or hey, you know, and some of them I don't blame. It's like you spend 10 years digging in the dirt in a specific area and you're going to tell some dude sitting in his mom's basement watching YouTube videos that person knows more about this ancient site. Like, no, you don't.
I know.
So, I think it's just, we all just have to be open-minded and honest with each other. And I think if we start there, just being honest with ourselves too, you know, if you have a weird experience, you have a weird experience. You don't need to, you know, add things to it or talk it up more or embellish or hyperbolize or whatever. That's where I come from. It's like, share your experience. Like you mentioned and, you know, it may be anecdotal. Maybe there's multiple people, whatever, but at the end of the day, just be open-minded. And we all come from different places and have different experiences. And again, the language thing is huge. What language are you using to refer to certain terms? And, you know, whenever you see a debate, that's why the people will agree on certain terminology before the debate. So when they get into it, people aren't being confused on their position, you know. It's the same kind of a thing. So it's the Wild West out there. What can you say? But listen, man, you're the next time you see Dr. Gregory on the show, he'll have some groundbreaking things to share, but we'll leave it at
we mentioned some of that. We'll have something to share. I appreciate it. Take care and good night or goodbye or good day to everybody.
So
watching.
We're gonna end this the way we always end that, all right, which is, we love everybody. Stay safe out there. We'll catch you next time.